Well, now we begin a new series of studies in our part of the Family Bible School, and that turns us to the Gospel of Matthew this morning. We're going to be looking at a section of Jesus' famous Sermon on the Mount, in which he talks to us, to his disciples, about behavior, about the law of God and his interpretation of it for those who follow him. The law of Christ, we've called it. In this opening study, we begin to read at verse 17 and continue through to verse 26. Matthew chapter 5, verse 17. Let's hear God's word together. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. I tell you the truth, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. Anyone who breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever practices and teaches these commands will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to his brother, Raca, is answerable to the Sanhedrin. But anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift. Settle matters quickly with your adversary, who is taking you to court. Do it while you are still with him on the way, or he may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. I tell you the truth, you will not get out until you have paid the last penny. On average, one person is killed every 12 hours in Britain. In some cases, the charge is murder, in others, manslaughter. It depends on the degree of premeditation and homicidal intent. But the result is the same in either case. Over 700 individuals every year dead as a result of criminal violence. In some ways, such a statistic is encouraging, because compared to many other parts of the world, this is still a relatively non-violent country. There are almost as many killings every year in the single city of Dallas, Texas, as there are in the whole of Britain. The United States regularly records annual homicide figures of over 24,000. We have a long way to go before we reach that kind of level of carnage. But the figures here are not getting any better. In fact, they have doubled in the last 30 years. And although the rate of increase is below the soaring incidence of other kinds of crime, like theft, for instance, there are some very worrying trends underlying these statistics, particularly as far as young people are concerned. Our police are getting particularly concerned about the increasing number of young people carrying knives. Psychologists in this country have found some disturbing evidence that increasing familiarity with fictional murder through the television, is hardening children in their attitudes towards violence. And those factors are just beginning to show in the statistics of murder. The issue, of course, was brought very emotively to the attention of the nation 6 months ago when 2-year-old Jamie Bulger, you remember, was abducted and killed by 2 older children near Liverpool. Ever since that shocking incident, it seems to me, there has been an increasing tide of articles and editorials and programs on the TV, all concerned with the urgent need to more successfully educate children and young people morally. How can we bring teenage crime figures down, they keep asking? How can we ensure that children respect other people's property and, even more importantly, other people's lives? Because if we don't succeed in that, it's only a matter of time before the streets of Britain are as dangerous as those of Dallas. Some people, of course, say the answer is more law and order. stricter discipline in school, tougher penalties in the courts, more police on the streets, bring back hanging, even. People have lost their respect for the rules that have to govern civilized society, we're told. Though that respect has to be restored. I don't know if you saw an article on August the 15th in the Sunday Telegraph. It expressed the point in typical fashion. It is the arguments of left-wing academics that are responsible for our present malaise, it said, speaking about the incidence of crime in the country. They preach a doctrine that first became prominent in the 1960s, but which stretches back to Rousseau, that man is inherently good and that he must cast off the chains of conventional behavior and morality that enslave him. The battle cry of the 60s was, do your own thing. 25 years later, that exaltation of rights over responsibilities has left in its wake the fearful legacy that drives today's crime figures upwards. Well, that's a sentiment which conservative Christians find it very easy to sympathize with. Contrary to the utopian optimism of humanists and socialists, the Bible teaches the pessimistic doctrine of original sin. Without a strong framework of socially enforced values and judicially enforced legislation, that innate wickedness, which is in all of us human beings, will always proliferate in society. The Ten Commandments were written in stone by the finger of God, precisely to prevent such moral decay in the ancient world, and woe betide the modern nation that ignores them. Though there is an enormous amount of truth in that response, that law and order response, if you like, to the crime problem, I think more and more people are beginning to realize. The permissive society, with its repudiation of moral absolutes, I think undeniably has contributed to the lack of moral conscience that all too often, all too sadly, one seems to observe in children and young people, the heirs of those swinging 60s. And yet it has to be said too, of course, that for the Christian, rules can't be a sufficient solution to this problem of the escalating statistics of crime. One of the cardinal ways the New Testament distinguishes itself from the Old is precisely in this matter, by its insistence that the law can't save the world. Nothing, I think, illustrates that better than Jesus' attitude towards the Pharisees and the scribes, the teachers of the law, in first century Judea. So here was a group of people who would have thoroughly endorsed that Sunday Telegraph editorial I just quoted. Honoring the law, keeping the law, that's what mattered, they said. That's what keeps society straight. And they devoted their lives to the goal of promoting the law with meticulous zeal. And yet, of course, as I guess most of us here know, Jesus habitually sought to distance himself both from their party and from their doctrine. He openly flouted many of the regulations that they insisted upon. He deliberately sought the company of men and women whom they regarded as morally defiled precisely because they broke their rules. And in his teaching, he constantly makes critical, even downright hostile comments about the style of piety which the Pharisees and the teachers of the law represent. He calls down upon them apocalyptic woes and urges his own disciples, do not be like them. Jesus' antagonism to the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, of course, inevitably led to the idea in many people's minds in his own day that since he was hostile to the chief representatives of the law, he was hostile to the law itself. He must be bringing some revolutionary new style of ethics that would replace the Ten Commandments altogether, they thought. But that was a mistake. It's a mistake Jesus himself is at pains to correct in this very section of the Sermon on the Mount that we've just read. Notice what he says in verse 17. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. Clearly some were already thinking he had, but he denies it. I have not come to abolish them, he says, but to fulfill them. I tell you the truth, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. Well, he could hardly affirm his loyalty to the Old Testament with greater force, could he? The Bible generally, and God's law in particular, he insists, will continue to be authoritative and relevant until the end of the world. His arrival as the Messiah has not abrogated that law, has not diminished its authority or its relevance in any way. Indeed, he says in verse 19, anyone who breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever practices and teaches these commands will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. Well, that being so, of course, the question we want to ask is, why are you so negative about the scribes and the Pharisees then, Jesus? I mean, surely by your own admission, they must be great in the kingdom of heaven. For who strives more energetically to practice and to teach the commandments of God than they do? And yet, surprisingly enough, that's exactly where Jesus disagrees. Now he goes on to say, my argument with the Pharisees and the teachers of the law is precisely that they do not keep God's commandments half well enough. Verse 20. For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. Jesus is here getting at a great irony, one in fact which occupies a great deal of the New Testament. The irony is that an excessive emphasis on obedience to moral rules, far from encouraging the kind of righteousness that God desires to see in us, can actually undermine it. Indeed, it can foster a form of moral blindness, which in its way is even more dangerous than the moral anarchy which the law is designed to prevent. And in the case of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law in Jesus' day, that moral blindness was precisely what characterized them. Now, to fully understand how the law of God can have so perverse, so surprising an effect on people, would require us surveying a lot more of the New Testament than just the passage we have in front of us this morning. It would mean us looking particularly at the writings of the Apostle Paul, who, as a converted Pharisee, of course, knew better than most people why rules aren't enough. But suffice it to say this morning, by way of introduction to this section in the Sermon on the Mount, that a moral education which consists simply in inculcating rules into people can, and very often does, distort people's perception of what real goodness means. And it does so in at least three ways. Let me just briefly outline them to you. The first way it does so is by encouraging casuistry. I don't know if you know that word. What I mean by it is this. It's very easy, if you focus your attention on the letter of the law rather than the spirit of the law, it's very easy to invent for yourself clever ways of evading the real moral force of that law while still technically obeying its legal formula. That's what the word casuistry means. And the scribes and the Pharisees of Jesus' day were past masters at it. If there was a permission in God's law, they would interpret it as widely as possible. If there was a prohibition in God's law, they would interpret it as narrowly as possible. In that way, you see, they gave themselves the maximum latitude for their own actions. Thus, they managed to make their servants work 7 days a week without, they were sure, technically breaching the fourth commandment about keeping the Sabbath. Thus, they enabled themselves to hoard money greedily, whilst at the same time convincing themselves they were not breaching the tenth commandment about coveting. It enabled them to tell deliberate lies and to break their promises to one another, without, they were sure, breaching that commandment that talks about false witness. And it enabled them to neglect the care of their parents, without, they were sure, breaching the fifth commandment that talks about honoring father and mother. It was precisely for this reason that Jesus says to them on one occasion, you set aside the commandment of God, observing instead your own human traditions. That was the meat and drink to the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. finding a way through the small print of God's law that enabled them, in effect, to evade it, while still technically, legally, obeying it. Wherever people define goodness in legal rather than moral terms, fundamentally, that sort of casuistry is a very real danger. The second way in which the law often, perversely, ironically, operates in such a way as to undermine real goodness rather than foster it is this. By encouraging people to excuse their irresponsibility. What I mean by this is that in a strange way, people sometimes hide from the pain and the challenge and the difficulty of personal decision-making by taking refuge in a sort of mindless, pedantic obedience to the rules. The perfectionist loves the rule book. It makes him feel secure. We witnessed a classic example of this in our own century. No society on earth was more inclined to law and order, to the obedience of the rule book, than pre-war Germany. But it was precisely that submissiveness to the law, to the rule, that Hitler exploited. Those who put the Jews into the gas chambers excused themselves by insisting they were simply obeying orders. Whenever, as I say, morality is defined essentially in legal terms, in terms of a rule book, that kind of evasion of responsibility becomes a possibility, an attractive possibility. And the scribes and the Pharisees were adept at exactly the same kind of defense. We have a law. And by that law, he ought to die, they screamed at Pilate. What could be a greater paradox than that? That the only truly innocent man that has ever walked the face of the earth was crucified because the rule book said he had to be. And that brings me to the third way in which law, all too often, can actually undermine real goodness. And that is by promoting self-righteousness. This, perhaps, from the New Testament's point of view, is the most damaging feature of a law-based ethic of all. It leads people to think that provided they can convince themselves that they haven't actually broken any of the rules, they are okay. They are good enough. When the truth is, of course, that that very pride in our own moral achievements is more morally obnoxious to God than any of those crimes we boast so smugly we have not committed. Jesus told a classic story about this, didn't he? A Pharisee who went into the temple with the overt intention of praying, but when he got there, all he did instead was to prate. Thank you, God, that I'm such a good person, he said. I never do this and I never do that. I always say my prayers and I always give my tithe. I keep the rules, God. How pleased you must be with me. How nice it must be for you to have a person like me in your kingdom. I said, Jesus, God would rather have had a corrupt tax collector or prostitute in the kingdom of heaven than that smug Pharisee. For as Paul would later explain, the reason God gave us the law was not so that we could persuade ourselves that we are righteous. The reason he gave us the law was precisely so that we would come to realize how desperately short we fall of God's standards. Not so that we proudly can justify ourselves, but so that we are thrown in desperation onto his mercy and grace. That's why God gave us the law. Moral rules, then, for all their wisdom, for all their unchanging relevance and authority, are not the real answer. The New Testament is convinced of that. That's why there has to be a New Testament. The kind of righteousness which the scribes and the Pharisees constructed for themselves by means of their punctilious obedience to God's law was just not good enough. A different kind of righteousness is required. A deeper kind of law. That's what we call the law of Christ. And Jesus spends this second half of chapter 5 in the Gospel of Matthew in his Sermon on the Mount expounding it for us, explaining for us what that deeper law is. Do you notice the repeated formula? It occurs in verse 21, in verse 23, verse 31, 37, 38, and 43. Six times it occurs in this second half of chapter 5. You have heard that it was said, but I tell you. It's important not to misunderstand those words. See, some people have jumped to the conclusion that Jesus is here repudiating the law of Moses and replacing it with something else. You've heard what the Ten Commandments say, now I'm going to tell you something different. But that can't possibly be his intention, can it? For he has just told us in verse 17, in the strongest possible terms, that it is not his intention to abolish or change God's law in any way. So what then is he doing in verse 21 and following when he says, you've heard that it was said, but I say unto you, the answer is this. He is expounding for us here the true demands of God's law in the face of those legalistic distortions in which the Pharisees and the scribes delighted, to whom he's just referred in verse 20 when he said, unless your righteousness exceeds theirs, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. He's going on to explain to us what that deeper righteousness is. His controversy is with the Pharisees and the scribes, not with Moses. Their business in life, as we've seen, was to evade the moral force of the law of God by means of their cunning and sophistical interpretations of God's word. What Jesus is doing is restoring that moral force, highlighting just what the Ten Commandments, properly understood, really do demand of a person. And thus clarifying for us why it is the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees isn't good enough for heaven. You can make a very strong case, in fact, for saying that when Jesus uses that phrase, you have heard that it was said, he is not referring primarily to the text of the Old Testament at all, even though he may sometimes go on apparently to quote from the Old Testament. But that is not his primary reference. When Jesus quotes from the Old Testament, he almost always uses a different form of words altogether. He says, it stands written. That's the verb he uses. It stands written. But this formula, you have heard that it was said, was in fact a pretty standard way in the first century by which rabbis alluded to the interpretations which had been handed down to them from earlier Hebrew scholars. Hence the choice of the verb. It was said. Jesus is not alluding to the written scriptures here, but to the oral traditions of the Jewish rabbis. Thus, when he goes on to say, you've heard that it was said, but I say unto you, he's not setting out to set his opinions over against the Bible. That's something, in fact, Jesus never does anywhere. No, the contrast he's drawing here is between the rabbinical understanding of the law of God, with all its casuistry and excuses and evasions, and his uniquely authoritative exposition of that law. It's as if he's saying, look, you've listened to all kinds of preachers and teachers in the past, and unfortunately, many of them have told you wrong. They've seared your conscience with their spurious arguments about what God's law really requires of you. Now, I've come to set the record straight. See, all they could do was to quote the legal opinion of earlier rabbis. But as God's Messiah, I have no need to rest my case on such legal precedents. I have the personal authority to deliver the ancient law of Moses to you afresh and to interpret its requirements to you with divine infallibility. You've heard that it was said, so and so. But you listen to what I'm telling you. That law, that ancient, infallible, and unchangeable law, really demands of you. But I say unto you. Let's see how that works out with the particular example that's before us this morning of the sixth commandment. Verse 21, you've heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. What the rabbis had done, you see, with the sixth commandment was that they had fused the unconditional imperative of God's law, thou shalt not kill, with this sanction against the crime that doesn't appear in the Ten Commandments at all. Anyone who murders will be subject to the judgment. I suspect the effect of that was to restrict the application of the Sixth Commandment, as far as they were concerned, narrowly to the physical act of murder, and the penalty of it to civil liability in the law courts of Israel. Thus, you see, a pious Pharisee, provided he'd never been prosecuted for murder, could put a large tick beside the Sixth Commandment. Yes, done that one, he could say. I've done that one, never been prosecuted for murder, I'm okay. Well, Jesus would have us know that only a seared conscience could possibly come to such a complacent conclusion. I tell you, anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment, he says. Oh, it may be true that you have not killed anyone with a knife or a gun, but there is more than one way to kill someone in God's eyes, he says. Think about it. Murder is the action of a man or woman who has no regard for the value of another human being. It's an act of supreme arrogance and contempt towards the value of another human being. Well, says Jesus, if you reflect upon it, you'll realize that we show precisely the same arrogance, precisely the same contempt, precisely the same lack of regard for somebody's value when we insult them. Whether we scoff at their stupidity or defame their character, verbal abuse is an assault. And it can be just as damaging in its way as physical violence. Or think of it another way. Murder is the action of a man or woman who has lost control of their passions. It is almost always an act of wild and explosive temper. That, says Jesus, if you reflect upon it, you'll realize we display precisely the same lack of self-control when we allow anger to get the better of us. There is only an inch of difference between hurling crockery at the wall in a fit of rage and hurling a knife at a person. Vilification and anger, then, have the same moral nature as murder. That's what Jesus is arguing. They're born of the same moral weakness. They reflect the same kind of mindset. And in the right circumstances, they yield the same lethal harvest. All right, Mr. Pharisee, maybe you haven't actually killed anybody yet. But if you make a habit of losing your temper or calling people names, the fact that you haven't committed murder is down more to luck or cowardice than it is to your sterling virtues. It's time you faced up to that. Oh, it's true that offences like anger and verbal abuse can't be very easily prosecuted in the civil law courts. The queue outside the Old Bailey would just be too long. But it isn't the judiciary of Israel at the end of the day we must ultimately fear, says Jesus. It's the judgment chamber of God. And make no mistake about it. Divine judgment is where that soul is bound who cannot control their temper. That habit of telling your brother to go to hell will take you to hell if you're not very careful, warns Jesus. It's a sobering warning, isn't it? Of course, it is important not to press Jesus' words too far. He's a good preacher, and like a good preacher, he allows himself a measure of rhetorical license in making his points. What Jesus is saying here does have to be qualified and held in tension with other things that we find about anger in the Bible. Jesus can't be saying, for instance, that all anger is inherently sinful, for the simple reason that we're told God is angry sometimes. Indeed, there are a number of incidents in the Gospels where Jesus displays what one can only call anger himself, as when he drove the money changers out of the temple precincts. There is such a thing, of course, as righteous indignation. It's a wholly appropriate, a wholly necessary response to wickedness and injustice. But Jesus is cautioning us very solemnly about the spiritual peril of misusing that emotion, that response, of letting anger get the better of us so that it ceases to be a rational and controlled response to evil and becomes instead a self-indulgent emotional response, passionate response to personal irritation of one sort or another. maybe the question on many of our hearts is, well, what on earth can we do to avoid the judgment of God in this matter? For we all know what it is to lose our temper irresponsibly and wrongly. Well, one of the interesting things about Jesus in his exposition of the law of God here in the Sermon on the Mount is that he never simply broadens the application of the law of God to these wide areas of human behaviour. He also gives pastoral counsel on how to handle such a law practically. And on this matter, you'll see, he has two very simple but very wise pieces of advice to offer us. If you have a problem, he says, about anger, losing your temper, here are two things you must remember. First, don't come to church until you've made it up. That's the force of verses 23 and 24. Therefore, he says, if you're offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift. Simple advice, but very wise, you see. You know you've upset somebody. You know they're angry with you, and maybe you're feeling angry with them too. Well, don't wait for them to make the first move, he says. Don't insist that they apologize. That's just a recipe for prolonging the antagonism. No. Make it a rule that before you come to church and ask for God's forgiveness, you have first received and offered forgiveness to your brother. Don't come to church until you've made it up. So important, isn't it? So important in our witness to the world. I mean, what use is it that we are seen on Sunday morning with a big Bible under our arm, traipsing off to church by our next door neighbour as he's washing his car, if the day before we were shouting abuse at him over the back garden fence? So important too, isn't it, in the life of the fellowship here at Eden. I'm sure you remember that little poem I've quoted before. To dwell above with saints we love. Ah yes, that will be glory. To dwell below with saints we know. Well, that's another story. We at Eden are not immune, are we, to interpersonal disputes and feuds of one sort and another. Here is Jesus' rule. If you know you and your brother are at loggerheads about something, don't come to church until you've made it up. We have a communion service tonight. What are we saying in that communion? We are saying we are one body in Christ, one loaf. Or maybe we should leave that broken bread on the plate then, until we really are one body. That's Jesus' first piece of advice then. Don't come to church till you've made it up. The second piece of advice? Keep short accounts with people, he says. Verse 25, settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court. Do it while you're still with him on the way, or he may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. I tell you the truth, you will not get out until you've paid the last penny. The point of this parable, this metaphor, is make friends again quickly. Don't let enmity and bitterness and hard feeling breed for a long time. Nip it in the bud, says Jesus. For we're all on the way to court. Oh, yes, we are. Even if our brother is not actually taking us to the civil courts, we are all on our way to the biggest assize of all, God's judgment throne. Make sure, he says, that you and your enemy are not called quickly before him in an unreconciled state. For as he has told us, anger and abuse are capital crimes, and we will be judged accordingly. Settle your differences quickly, then, says Jesus, out of court. You don't need me to tell you how many situations there are in the world that would just never arise as problems if people obeyed this simple rule to settle matters quickly and not allow resentment to fester. Yeah, think of Bosnia and Northern Ireland and the Palestine. These things are in the newspaper so much just at the moment. What are they all about? They're about resentments that go back centuries, diligently nurtured in people's hearts over all that time. Think of your own workplace, some of you who work in offices and factories. So much of the tension that you find there is due to people holding on to resentments and bitternesses, isn't it? And of course, It's true in marriages and families too, isn't it? How much bitterness is experienced there, on the domestic scene, quietly perhaps and not recognised by those outside, because we hold on to our resentments and our anger. We don't deal with it quickly with the individual concerned. There's that old maxim, of course, isn't there? Never go to bed angry. Stay up and fight. Well, there's a certain amount of wisdom in it. At least if the fighting eventually turns into loving again. Certainly better that than go to bed fuming with contained, repressed resentment. Shall I tell you a slightly unexpected fact, perhaps, about those murder statistics I quoted right at the beginning? Only a tiny fraction of those killings are the work of professional hitmen, or criminal gangs, or homicidal maniacs. The vast majority of those 700 who die each year know the person who kills them personally. Nearly half the cases involve a domestic dispute. And in more than a third of the cases, the person eventually charged or convicted for the crime comes from the close family circle of the victim. Think about that. Murder in this country is not primarily related to the increasing incidence of organized crime or the mismanagement of schizophrenics or anything like that. Murder in this country primarily reflects the breakdown in interpersonal relationships between ordinary, sane people, people like you and me, and in particular, it reflects breakdown in family relationships. It isn't then, at the end of the day, more law and order that is going to do anything to reduce those homicide statistics, is it? It's more give and take. More give and take between people like us. Particularly in the home. That's where a 13-year-old boys are going to learn that you don't need to carry a knife to be somebody. In the home. By our example, by watching the way we live, the way we deal with hostility and disagreement in the family circle. Penalizing murder in the courts is shutting the stable door after the horse is bolted. Jesus is showing a penetrating insight here when he says that what the sixth commandment is really about is the cultivation of a gentle spirit. A spirit that is not easily provoked. A spirit that does not indulge in careless verbal venom. A spirit that is quick to forgive and to ask for forgiveness. Don't come to church then till you've made it up. And keep short accounts. Let's pray together.